Blog Talk Radio.
Mama Africa, Mama Africa, am I coming home? Am I coming home? Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I'm feeling fine, and I hope you're fine too. Hello, Mama Africa, how are you? I hope when you hear these words, your gray turn blue, gray turn blue. I'm saying these words to let you know how much I care and I won't let go. Even though we're oceans away, you're
Africa. Welcome to another episode, another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and I'm joined on the line with our co-host, Peter Fowler from Glendale, Arizona, who I will have him introduce himself in a second. But welcome on this March, if you're on in the D.C. area, very dreary March 29th, dreary because of the weather, dreary because we're still under the yoke of imperialism, of the empire, of institutional racism, of institutional white supremacy. But tomorrow is a new day, and for those of us that continue to resist and continue to fight, we know that those are the things that we always live for: is the next day to fight, the next day to resist. the next day to organize, the next day to mobilize. That is what it's about. That is what it's about, fighting for each person, for each community, for each country, for one world. So until we rid this world of the institutional isms, you know, the capitalism, institutional racism, institutional white supremacy, even though it's not an ism, but I could I put that in the same category. So welcome, and we got a great episode for you today. Peter and I have a wonderful interview lined up for you all. Brother Monty Smith, who was one of the dopest spoken word artists that you have never heard, unless you've heard him. You know, so maybe some people out there have heard him. But if you haven't heard him, there's one of the dopest MCs or spoken word artists that you have yet to hear. He'll be joining us from North Carolina. The brother has received a ton of praise and accolades from spoken word artists that actually count, whose opinions actually matter. And so he'll be joining us at 9 p.m. But, you know, Peter and I got some headlines to make our way through. And let me not be rude, and let me introduce the number, the call-in number, if anybody wants to call in at any particular time. The call-in number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. We welcome calls, comments, queries, all that stuff. So, Peter, can you introduce yourself, just in case we have any new listeners to Your World News?
No doubt. So, Alan, good to be with you. Again, I'm looking forward to this show, looking forward to looking at some news and to interviewing Brother Monty Smith. I'm Peter Fowler in Glendale, Arizona, and I'm a critical theorist with the Academy of Critical Thinking. You can find us at theactinc.org on the web. And that's what critical theorist does, and that's what the Academy of Critical Thinking does, is to always find a way to resist and to be part of the struggle. So that's what we're doing on the air right now, and taking a critical, insightful look at national news, world news, and what's going on in the world. So looking forward to another opportunity to challenge and oppose the existing mythology, Solomon. So let's get it started, bro.
All right, and without further ado, here's our first clip provided to us by none other than Black Agenda Report and Brother Glenn Ford and Brother Bruce Dixon and Brother Jared Ball, Margaret Kimberly, and all the good folks that are associated with Black Agenda Report, www.blackagendareport.com. Visit the website. Every Wednesday, new news items, but you can visit it throughout the week. It's a tremendous website, tremendous information, critical analysis that you will not get from the Western corporate media. I say media, don't want to say news, because I would have to put quotation marks around the news. But since we're on radio, you guys can't seem to put those quotation marks. So anyways, here's our first clip from Black Agenda Report, and we'll see you on the other end, and we'll dice this up a little bit.
Tens of thousands of immigrants and their supporters gathered in Washington this past weekend to beseech President Obama to move this year on immigration reform. It's doubtful they will get their wish, but supporters of meaningful change in U.S. immigration policies ought to be careful what they wish for. This president is no more interested in real reform in U.S. immigration policy than in genuine reform of the health care system. He is joined at the hip with those corporate forces that would condemn immigrants, especially those who are not white, to a world of shadows and perpetual insecurity, always at the mercy of some kind of cop. Obama was cheered by thousands of demonstrators when his image appeared on giant screens on the Capitol Mall. "I've always pledged to be your partner," said Obama, "and that's a commitment that I reaffirm today." But Obama's commitments to common people are rhetorical and transient, while his ties to the economic and political elite are permanent. On the immigration front, Obama's practice is little different from that of the Bush administration. His administration continues Bush's policy of deputizing local police agencies to enforce immigration laws, a formula for racial profiling and police abuse on a massive scale. The infamous 287G program was passed into law in 1996 in the wake of the Oklahoma City bombing. The perpetrator of the Oklahoma City attack was a white right-wing terrorist, but the law allowed the federal government to turn local law enforcement loose on mostly non-white immigrants. In many localities, the program has the effect of putting people who appear to be foreign-looking at the mercy of every racist with a badge. President Obama could bring the local police immigration enforcement programs to a virtual halt administratively without consulting the Congress, but he has not, which shows his true intentions. Obama is on record in support of a U.S. Senate immigration bill, co-sponsored by New York Democrat Charles Schumer and South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham. Under their legislation, it is generally agreed that immigration authority raids will increase, resulting in huge growth of immigration detention centers, which already incarcerate 350,000 people per year, the fastest growing sector of the American prison gulag. The bill would require a national ID card, something even George Bush found repugnant and that progressives have long opposed. But as with every other issue, when Barack Obama stands for an expanded police state, most of the American left sits down and shuts up. The Schumer, Graham, Obama bill would ensure that U.S. corporations get all the low-wage immigrant workers they want through programs in which guest workers would have little leverage to improve their working conditions. And of course, the Obama administration has no intention of altering their beloved free trade policies that have destabilized the peasant and working classes of Mexico and Central America, fueling the human flow northward. Jesse Jackson, Cornel West, and the heads of the NAACP and the National Urban League spoke in solidarity with the immigrants, which is as it should be. But there can be no triumph for immigrant civil rights in a police state or in a world where inequality is the biggest U.S. export. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Yeah, that's I want to jump right into that. And, I, for those that are listening, that it's immigration, man. This is a huge battle that continues to be waged, throughout America, and it's a country that excluding the rightful landholders and owners of this land, the indigenous folks, everybody else, excluding Africans who were stolen from their home continent and brought here by shiftless, lazy Europeans. But everyone else, for all intents and purposes, was an immigrant, was an immigrant in some shape, form, or fashion. But what's left, what I'm trying to get at, because I'm kind of digressing, but the point I want to bring in is this contextual dialogue that needs to occur, that we know it's just simply not going to occur on the mainstream corporate media. It's absolutely not, and it's not going to probably occur in the halls of Congress. And Glenn Ford alluded to it. That is the fact that what the U.S. did for all those nitwits out there that are raising hell about we don't want no illegal immigrants in our country and this, that, and the other, which totally, it's such a ridiculous term and beyond ridiculous. It's vastly like racist and repugnant. But all this like idiots out there just chipping and chapping and running off the mouth about immigration and how let's not get it twisted. They're not talking about immigrants. They're not talking about Eastern Europeans that are coming in. They're not talking about white Canadians that are coming in from north of the border. You know, this is, you know, these racist fools that they're talking about folks coming in from south of the border, from Mexico, from Central America. And what they don't ever talk about, because either one, A, they're a bunch of ignorant mental midgets, which, yeah, a lot of them are. And then beyond that, they are those that aren't, you know, are a bunch of racist scumbags, you know, that really kind of follow their sheep, and they follow the talking points of their government. And what's missing, Peter, is they don't ever talk about, you know, so if you're all fired up, and I've said this so many times, I've said this many, many times, is that if you're all fired up, if you have a problem with immigrants coming from south of the border, you know, let's go to the root cause. Why would scores of people from everywhere from Mexico to Central America be coming into the U.S.? Let's chart it. And then, you know, I say, look at the number of Mexicans coming into this country from Mexico, obviously, into the U.S., whether it's Arizona where you live in, or Texas, or Florida, what, you know what I'm saying, what have you, you know, different routes that they're taking, you know, by land, sometimes by sea. You know, let's look at this influx that really started to be pushed in the early 1980s, the mid-80s. What, you know what I'm saying, these idiots never want to look at, they never want to like dissect and follow the route and see what really precipitated these folks to come, you know, to leave wonderful climates, much better climates than I live in, you know what I'm saying, in the mid-Atlantic. You know, what would precipitate them to leave these beautiful land that they come from, tropical climates and so forth, to come to the U.S. And when you pull up America's ugly skirt, when you pull up her ugly skirt and you see America's secrets, what they're not willing to face up is their government played a major role in A, doing everything from, we can talk about NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement. Notice, free trade agreement, not fair trade agreement, but NAFTA and the role NAFTA has played, as Glenn Ford alluded, in destabilizing the economies and the working class of Mexico, which is basically NAFTA has provided to be an additional life support system for sweatshops, for just treating people basically like indentured servants, you know, where, you know, women are making just, you know, basically dollars a week. And then beyond that, and then we look at Central America, Peter. We look at everywhere from Honduras to El Salvador to Nicaragua. You know what I'm saying? We look at the role the U.S. played in destabilizing those communities by financing death squads. Yes, financing murder and death. And that's exactly, you know what I'm saying? And so the U.S. never wants to talk about this, never wants to talk about this. So if folks came into your community and they were financed by another government and these folks were coming there and they were killing people wholesale, I think that a lot of folks in your community might be jumping ship and fleeing and trying to run and get the hell out of Dodge as quickly as they possibly can. So that's a different view of immigration that we seldom hear in the mainstream media. We seldom hear in schools, whether it may be middle schools or high schools, social studies, civics courses, when they talk about immigration. That's seldom a dialogue that we hear in even higher education, so-called higher education. It's buried. It's a stinky little truth. And these folks, you know what I'm saying, have been killed, you know what I'm saying, on our dime. Whether you like it or not, it's been killed. They've been killed in your name by your government. You know what I'm saying? So that's just that's what I got to say about immigration right there, because I don't want to, you know, I know, Pete, you have a lot to say, you know, maybe, you know, I'll shut up right now.
Well, you bring up a lot of good points, Solomon, you know, particularly the role of capital
in why individuals and families are leaving their homelands, their beautiful homelands. You're right. Why leave these gorgeous climates of Central America to come to scattered all across the United States, oftentimes in cold climates, in urbanized and ghettoized areas, or in rural areas where a lot of these immigrants are forced into jobs that no one else wants. So they're working in meatpacking plants, they're working in rendering plants, they're working in dirty, lousy, low-paying jobs, which relative to coming to many of these impoverished Central American nations, the wages are pretty good. But nevertheless, you have to ask that question, like you just stated. Why would these folks pick up and leave, and many of them leaving individually by themselves, leaving their families behind, to come up here and to work in these ugly and unattractive and low-paying jobs? What is behind that? See, those are some of the questions that are never asked, because obviously the media is not taking a critical perspective or a critical look at the big picture in terms of what's going on. And it is the role of global capital. You know, how come nobody ever questions? And when I say nobody, I mean in the public dialogue, in the public discourse, in the media, in the government. There's nobody that raises the question or raises the issue of why is it that global capital is able and allowed to cross borders freely and come and go as it pleases. And that is ingrained in policy. That's what NAFTA and other treaties like it, that's what that is. That allows global capital, in other words, corporations, businesses that are based in America, to operate in other countries. And one of the things that is so insidious about that is that those treaties like NAFTA, they override international law. So the corporations literally are above the law when it comes to a wide variety of policies that relate to the international trade agreements. And so, you know, that's the angle that we never hear of in the media. That's an angle that the government doesn't want us to take in terms of looking at what's going on with these individuals coming into our country. You know, and so what it does is it exposes the hypocrisy of this anti-immigration policy when global capital corporations, these multinational corporations with multi-billion dollar profit lines, are able to move freely back and forth over borders with impunity, many of them paying no taxes whatsoever to either country, any of the countries in which they're doing business. And so it's blame the victim. And so the poor Mexican farmer who, because of the influx of American agribusiness and their products being sold super cheap, they come in to Mexico and undersell the Mexican farmers. What are the Mexican farmers to do? I mean, if the folks here were to put themselves in the shoes of some of the individual immigrants and understand that these people are trying to survive, to use a Bushism, they're trying to put food on their families. All right, and so you know they're driven by the same kind of instincts that everybody in this country is driven by when they get up in the morning and go to work. They're trying to make a life for themselves. They're trying to provide for their families, and it is global capital that makes that damn near impossible in their homelands. So you know that you're exactly right. And I'll tell you what, I didn't grow up in this area. I grew up in the Rust Belt of Northeast Ohio, and so living here in Phoenix, I see a whole different side of it. The Phoenix area, this part of the country, is like ground zero for the anti-immigration battles in terms of, you know, being this close to the border with Mexico. And I'll tell you what, out here, this anti-immigration ideology is what it does is it fuels these white supremacist, racist organizations to organize into to militias and to vigilante groups, and they patrol the border, and you know what, the authorities let them do it, you know, because why? Because, you know, that's the history of this country, is white skinned folks are allowed to murder and brutalize brown skin and black skin people with impunity. It's the American way, you know. So it's really, really ugly out here, and obviously in other parts of the country as well. But it's a real issue
for all of us across this country, particularly, as the title of a recent book indicates, the browning of the country continues. You know, more and more Central and South Americans are coming into this country, and it's something that we have to deal with, and they're going to have to deal with more as time goes on.
Yeah, well, I welcome it with open arms. I welcome it. You know what I'm saying? You know,
mm-hmm.
White folks have absolutely zero. I mean, they'll create, you know, this false foundation, but they have absolutely zero foundation to stand on in terms of, like, you know, trumpeting, saying, this is our country. No,
right.
No, your country is across the Atlantic, someplace, you know, where your ancestors are originally from, whether it's someplace in Western or Central or Eastern Europe. No, you're you know what I'm saying? This is not your country. This was stolen. These are
think about the region I'm in, brother. I mean, Arizona. I mean, at one point, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas. This was Mexico, and
Mexicans. You know what I'm saying? The original Mexicans were indigenous. You know what I'm saying? And the reason they speak Spanish is because they were colonized by Europeans known as Spaniards. You know what I'm saying? And that's why you have because if you take somebody that, you know what I'm saying, is I don't know if there's a typical looking like Mexican, but you know what I'm saying, what somebody would envision in their head, you know, a brown skinned, you know, Mexican, and you know, you put them in North Dakota, you know, in this prison camp known as a reservation, which are throughout America known as, you know, Pine Ridge, and you put them there, you know, they look no different than the folks there. They might not be speaking Spanish, you know, on reservations in North Dakota and South Dakota, but you know, the reason why is, as you alluded to, is as you said, you know, like Mexico, California. I mean, San Francisco is named after the Franciscan monks. Same thing with San Diego. These were murderous, you know what I'm saying, monks that turned, you know, these vigilante like cowboys out to like murder and maim any indigenous folks throughout California.
Exactly.
that were resisting. But that's the claim of America, is to basically name monuments and towns and cities after murderous scumbag, you know, evil folks that, you know, hopefully are rotting in hell right now. But I join in solidarity with my brothers and sisters throughout Latin America who are here, not necessarily because they wanted to, but because they were forced out of their country for one reason or another. And a lot, oftentimes that reason is because of the residual effects or a lot of times the direct effects of U.S. policy, U.S. Foreign policy, U.S. subsidized murder, all those types of things. And, you know, I often have to tell, you know, brothers and sisters, you know, who are African-American, you know, to, like, pump the brakes when I start hearing this, you know, these stupid conversations based around, they're taking our jobs. I'm like, no, you limited fool. You're, you know what I'm saying? You're limiting, you know, and they've done a good job in terms of limiting your range of thought. Because what you need to do is to think about it. You're getting spit. You are getting nothing. You're getting crumbs. And you know, this Mexican or this Salvadorian or this this Honduran, they are also getting crumbs. All right? So for you to say that they are taking your jobs, you're not getting. The pie is this big. And these white folks, this elite class, have cut a little sliver off of that pie and allowed it to dry out in the sun, broken it up into crumbles, and thrown it at your ass, thrown it at them. You know what I'm saying? It's a classic divide and conquer. So instead of you saying, hey, let's go ahead and mobilize, and the same thing, yeah, and you unfortunately, you have some limited thinking Central Americans and Mexicans who think their common enemy is black folks, you know what I'm saying, who think it's limited, you know, as some black folks do, and say, oh, you know what I'm saying, that's my enemy, this, whatever. And it's the classic divide and conquer. when really they need to be joining forces, creating coalitions. Who gives a damn, you know what I'm saying, about your cultural differences? Cultural differences should be embraced, all right? Because differences do not mean deficient. They should be embraced. But these cultural differences should not mean that you can't create coalitions. You need to create coalitions, join up, mobilize, support one another in solidarity in different types of issues that both populations are facing that are intrinsic to those populations, and also some things that are intrinsic to both populations, and fight for that rightful piece of the pie that you deserve. You know what I'm saying? And stop having these stupid
jobs. Well, you know, first of all, if anybody has hold to, you know, the mythology that America is this melting pot. Well, you know, how come that doesn't stand today? You know, it was okay when Irish folks were pouring into this country, and when Polish folks were pouring into this country, and when German folks were pouring into this country, when Mexicans and Salvadorans and Hondurans, like you said, apparently there's a problem with that. You know, and who's taking whose jobs? You know, it's the corporatist at his utter madness.
Exactly. And that's why I'm really looking forward to 9 o'clock, because Monty Smith, beyond being a street poet as defined by himself, you know, he talks about these coalitions that need to be joined beyond, you know, between black and brown skin folks, and as well as with, poor folks, you know, regardless of their skin color, you know, and I say that, you know, because I will join coalitions with poor white folks who are not, you know, who don't have the seed of whatever. But unfortunately, well, I don't want to say unfortunate because it makes it sound like I give a damn about poor white folks who are, you know, racist to the core, or feel like, you know, that they feel like that they're actually supremacist to me in some shape, form, or fashion. I give two craps about them. But there are some working class folks, you know, from all different races that do see, you know, common interests and commonalities and have a somewhat worldview with one another that are black, brown, and white, and in that's that working class that really needs to create these coalitions and to mobilize and to organize, much like these nitwits, these racist white nationalist mental midgets, the Tea Parties, tea baggers or tea partiers, you know, are doing. You know, that's the kind of movement that we need to continue. And, you know, Black is Back Coalition is one of those. And hopefully that I would be remiss if I didn't mention one grassroots organization that has played a major role in mobilizing and registering a lot of poor folks, mainly poor folks of color throughout this country, in terms of registering to vote and also helping to find them jobs. And they just met their quasi-demise this past week, and so I want to play this clip, and we can chop it up on the other end.
All right.
The United States Congress's chief responsibility is to make laws, but the legislative branch of government often behaves as if it does not understand or respect the rule of law. In its treatment of the grassroots activist organization ACORN, Congress has acted like a mob whipped into an hysteria by Republicans and their servants in the corporate media. Back in September, Congress voted to halt all government payments to ACORN, including millions in contracts for counseling poor and middle-income on October 1st. So it comes as somewhat of a surprise that Obama's Justice Department has taken the position that the federal government should honor the contracts it entered into with ACORN, despite the Congress's actions. Essentially, the Justice Department takes much the same position as a suit brought by ACORN that claims the defunding legislation should be considered an illegal punishment of specific people and groups by Congress. That's called a bill of attainder, and it is prohibited by the U.S. Constitution. Justice Department lawyers wrote the legal opinion back on October 23rd, but the memo was only posted last week. The lawyers recommended that the government honor its contracts and continue making payments to ACORN, which has collected about $53 million for services rendered to governmental agencies since 1994. Acorn's suit to keep its contracts names as defendants the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and the head of the Office of Management and Budget. The newly released Justice Department memo reads like a friend of the court brief in favor of Acorn's position. But one should not jump to the conclusion that the Obama administration, which signed off on the anti-Acorn legislation, has had a sudden change of heart. Rather, this is almost certainly a case of the executive branch protecting itself from congressional efforts to defund organizations employed by the federal government, organizations like the mercenary outfit formerly known as Blackwater, for example. Acorn wrote the book on stabilizing poor and working-class neighborhoods under siege by predatory lenders, long before the financial crash. For many years, Acorn was the authoritative source on the looming subprime housing catastrophe abetted by both Democrats and Republicans in Congress and the White House. When Acorn's message turned out to be horrifically accurate, members of both parties tried to kill the messenger. Regardless of its motives, the Justice Department legal position on the Acorn suit is beneficial to the people's interests. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And I want to follow up with that, this one. That was to give a little bit of context, and I want to follow up with the most recent news surrounding Acorn.
The loss of the grassroots social change organization Acorn is a huge setback to the cause of economic and racial justice in the United States. Born in the 70s from roots in civil rights, welfare rights, and workers' rights organizing, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform, NOW, once boasted membership of 400,000 families in chapters across the country. This week, Acorn, or what was left of it, announced that it would fully dissolve itself by April 1st. Most of the group's chapters had already disbanded in order to reorganize under different names. New York Acorn has become New York Communities for Change. California Acorn now goes by the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment. And Acorn Housing became Housing Centers of America. Some Acorn activists say they're not disbanding, but simply rebranding. No matter what it's called, the demise of the national operation is as complete as it was sudden. Acorn was brought low by what began as a political sting operation, in which two right-wing operatives, posing as a pimp and a prostitute, tricked local Acorn staffers into appearing to give advice on hiding ill-gotten income. Republicans seized on the footage and previous problems with the organization's voter registration activities to nail Acorn to the cross. Congress was easily stampeded into passing a bill to withdraw all federal funding to Acorn affiliates that had assisted low-income Americans on housing and other matters, work that had earned Acorn $54 million over the years. The legislation was, in fact, an unconstitutional bill of attainder, that is, special legislation designed specifically to harm a political opponent. A federal judge agreed and issued an injunction prohibiting Congress from cutting off Acorn funds, now or in the future. But the damage was done. A cascade of private contributors withdrew their support, sending Acorn into a death spiral. Now, with Black and progressive forces at their weakest state in at least two generations, there no longer exists a mass, grassroots organization with the numerical forces or political will to directly confront rampaging capital and its servants in government. Acorn has passed into the realm of nostalgia. For decades, Acorn was the rock on which resistance to predatory lending stood. No organization came close to Acorn in documenting and organizing against financial sector housing policies that finally came crashing down on minority neighborhoods nationwide, destroying generations of black wealth. In recent years, it fought an ultimately unsuccessful battle for a living wage in New Orleans, the poorest big city in the United States, and provided the troops for a momentous fight against Walmart in Chicago. Acorn, it seemed, was everywhere in the struggle, and now it's gone. There are many lessons to be learned from the practice of an organization that has been at the forefront of struggle for 40 years. One is, don't depend on Democratic politicians in a pinch. They are mostly worthless. And two, don't build your house on federal funding, because the revolution will definitely not be subsidized. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Ain't that the truth? Do not build your organization on federal funding, because with federal funding, especially if it's a grassroots organization that is primarily comprised by people of color to help people of color, they can pull back at any given time. And that was one of the beauties of Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, otherwise known as UNIA, is that he used, the funds from a lot of his entrepreneurial efforts, such as his Black Star shipping line, to fund the movement. But in this country, we're still living in America spelled with a KKK. And, it's the parallels, as you are probably thinking about it, they run abound. And one of them is the fact that, one of the hypocrisies is that, he mentioned, Blackwater, you can talk about Halliburton, you can talk about a lot of different big corporate, entities that have received government funding for a long, long time. And didn't have this kind of onslaught by folks from both sides of the aisle, because they were Democrats. They were Democrats, Claire McCaskill, hell, I don't know what the hell she was thinking. Claire McCaskill, who had, came out, against Acorn. Alan Grayson, who's been a progressive voice for single payer, but he came out against, saying that Acorn needed to be penalized, thankfully he followed up by saying that, so did Halliburton and Blackwater. Acorn didn't need to be penalized. You know what I'm saying? That was one instance, and the folks were pretty much baited into it by these white, conservatives that went in there, like Glenn Ford said, and posed as a prostitute and a pimp, but that didn't, that episode did not merit or warrant, Acorn losing millions of dollars of government subsidies. But like I said, it was a total, race had so much to do with it. Race had so much to do with it. And the face of Acorn was a black face. When people thought of Acorn, they thought of poor black folks, poor brown folks. And so, the only thing I can say exactly, man, when you receive government money, federal funding, under this type of government, until America has a truly progressive government across the board, and I dare to say I don't think that will be in my lifetime, unfortunately. They can pull this out of the rug, pull your outfit right from underneath you, meaning that they'll pull the money right away at any time that you try to step outside of that box. So, Pete.
Yeah, what this is, what we've seen with the demise of Acorn is nothing less than it's an assassination. It's a racial assassination of an organization, not an individual. And if we look at what an assassination is, it's a politically motivated killing that sends a message. So assassinating Acorn or the attack on Acorn was also symbolic, because of what the work that Acorn did. You look at the neighborhoods, the communities that Acorn was active in, the types of families and communities that Acorn helped to lift up and to provide some means of better lifestyle for, and you're right, it's clearly people of black and brown skin, and so that's that's just not going to be tolerated by the apparatus in this country. And the historical parallels are stunning. When you look at the backlash from Reconstruction, by how racists organized into groups after Reconstruction, the Ku Klux Klan is probably the best known, but there's also the Red Shirts. There's the White League, and then and some of and groups just like them, and they were also political as well as just terrorist organizations. But their political involvement is what helped to bring down Reconstruction, and you know, we see this the same lines of continuity up through the backlash of the civil rights era. And, you know, the White Citizens Councils and the backlash to all the gains that were made through the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and those kind of things, and the racial retrenchment of regressive conservative Americans, and how they worked to eliminate much of the gains or even stop dead in its tracks, the very trajectory of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society initiatives. I mean, if you think about what's the one war that the United States, gave up on. You know, they waved the red flag. It was like, well, we never lost a war. What about the war on poverty? You know, that was a Lyndon Johnson era initiative, and all of a sudden, well, we just give up. We're not going to bother to fight that war. That literally happened. You know, the Nixon administration came along and was, well, we just don't have the funds for that, so we give up. They gave up on the war on poverty. And, you know, we look at the tactics of some of these terror groups over the last 150 years, and then we look at the groups like the one you mentioned, the Teabag group. You know, some of the things that the Red Shirts did was to disrupt Republican rallies or political rallies. Now, keep in mind, back in the late 19th century, the Republicans were was the political party that was parallel to today's Democrats. They were the ones in which black folks were involved. They were seen as the liberal political party. So the Red Shirts went in and they would disrupt those kind of rallies. They disrupted the political processes of any kind of liberal politics in this country. Now, doesn't that sound like what the Republicans of this century did during the town hall meetings for healthcare last summer? It sounds exactly like what they did. They intimidated black politicians and other black leaders. Look what happened with Van Jones. He got harassed to the point where he was forced out of his position in the Obama administration. They suppressed the black vote through all kinds of means. Doesn't that sound like what Diebold did through the Bush Klan over the last 8 years? I mean, so the historical parallels are very clear. You know, so this isn't just a new phenomenon. This isn't just a legitimate look into an organization that might have had some questionable practices. Not at all. This is the historical continuation of institutionalized racism that dominates the political climate and culture of this country. Nothing less. And the demise of ACORN was an assassination of an organization working on the behalf of black and brown-skinned people and poor people in this country.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And the beat goes on. And I'm glad you mentioned, even Van Jones, man. If he didn't know about Obama before he took that post, and clearly he may not have been willing to recognize who he was ultimately working for. He found out quickly. Obama didn't say a damn thing. Didn't come to his defense or aid
in any
shape, form, or fashion. That's
not at all.
That's the president, man. That's Obama. You know, when I ask questions about what targeted measures you have for black unemployment, you know, which was, you know, at the time when that question was asked, something like 16%, which really means that it's probably close to double that in all actuality. And his response to that reporter was, you know, to quote, it seems like his idol, Ronald Reagan, the evil, devilish Ronald Reagan, you know, quoted him, you know, by saying, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. Rising tide lifts all boats. So if I lift the tide, I will lift all boats, you know. But, when you have disproportionate effects of poverty and those types of things, you know, not to mention the myriad other social issues that plague Black communities. When you have disproportionate social issues affecting a demographic of folks, you must take disproportionate actions to create some type of equity and to provide some type of relief for those folks. But Obama, I mean, he is what he is, and I've been saying this since way before the election. You know, I'm so glad. You know, it was really unpopular then. It's still kind of unpopular to come out against Obama, but I thankfully did, like I said before, proudly voted for Senator McKinney. I was not one of the Obamanistas that were, you know, sucking up under him, and you know, you couldn't. There's so many folks that I know that no matter how many facts in terms of his voting record, in terms of what he said, there's nothing I could say. Maybe there's maybe about 2% of them that actually listened and actually took the time to research and whatever. But the vast majority of them made excuse after excuse, said no, this, that, and the other, had the loser mentality. Oh, if I can't vote for a loser, I can't vote for someone that can't win, you know, such as Cynthia McKinney, so I'm not going to vote for McCain. And I mean, you've already lost. You lost your mind, you damn fool. You lost your mind. You lost your mind. They have co-opted your mind, and they have limited your range of thought. Then they put you in this little tiny box and said, listen, brother, listen, sister, you don't think outside this box. You just keep thinking that you got two choices. You keep thinking that you got two choices, and you pick one of those two choices. And in all actuality, for us, for the power structure that runs shit, for us, the differences are so minute that even if you pick the other one, you know what I'm saying, the candidate that we're not necessarily supporting, it's still a win-win for us because they're going to support us all the way to the bank. And so that's why it didn't make a difference. So that dude comes in and institutes a bailout of $12.8 trillion. You know what I'm saying? Now floating out there to the Wall Street banksters, you know what I'm saying? And floating out there right now, you know, anywhere between $700 and $1,000 trillion in derivatives, which I still have yet to really fully understand what a derivative is. It's a lot of money. You know what I'm saying? It's a lot of money. And this dude was very, 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 very willing and eager to bail out Wall Street and not to bail out your black ass, your brown ass that didn't want to listen to me, that didn't want to listen to Peter, that didn't want to listen to, you know what I'm saying, Tyrone, that didn't want to listen to the brother on the street who knew the time. You know what I'm saying? You said he was full of crap. You said I was just being too radical. I just didn't want to go with the flow. And so what I had to do was to support Obama, because you know what? Obama's just doing this. He's just saying all this for the white man. Once he gets in power, once he gets into office in January, he's going to start to put all these reforms out there, and he's going to provide you instantaneous jobs, and he's going to do this, that, and the other. And it didn't
happen. That was the biggest joke.
Mm-hmm. What was the next excuse, Peter? The next excuse was, oh, he inherited it. He inherited it.
Right.
He didn't start the, you know what I'm saying, this war and that war, but I'll tell you what, the Afghanistan war is his now, because he escalated, and he said he was going to escalate it before he was voted in, and he kept his word. He said, oh yeah, I said I was going to escalate it, and now you sure damn well better believe I'm going to escalate. He escalated it, and he got in, and oh yeah, I didn't do the initial bailout. Bush did one bailout, was something like $800 billion. I'm gonna really blow this MF out the box. How about a $12.8 trillion bailout for Wall Street? How's that, Bush? I took it up a standard, and Bush was spending was spending something like $600 billion. You know what I'm saying, for his budget in any given fiscal year that he was in office. So Obama gets in. And look, you go. Listen, people, don't believe me? Go to whitehouse.gov. Look at what his White House for this coming fiscal year, minimally, what they're spending on defense. And I like to say it's the Department of Aggression, because you know the U.S. likes to go into other countries and exert their aggression. And that's what they do, Peter. That's what they do, man. That's what Obama does, man. That's what he does, and he does it so well. And he does it so well. And the same time, you got a bunch of sheep walking around, you know what I'm saying, not even wondering why they're still so poor, why they're young, why their 18-year-old boy who because of living conditions, enlisted in the Marines, and because there's an 85% deployment chance that he's going to get sent to Afghanistan, Iraq. That's why he's in Iraq or again Afghanistan right now. You know what I'm saying? Dodging bullets for his life. You know what I'm saying? For his life. They don't even want to think about that stuff, Peter. They don't want to think about that. They want to continue to support the Pied Piper, that wants to, you know, appropriate $700 and some odd billion. And that's not even including the war. They're appropriations for war. That's by Congress, man. This is what he's saying. I'm gonna write you off. Oh, yeah, brother. I'm gonna break you off $700 billion.
And in addition to that, I mean, in addition to that defense, there's other money that we don't see in the budgets for the war, like the money that is appropriated for the mercenaries companies, like Blackwater and so forth. That money is a line item elsewhere. So there's money, there's all kinds of money that we don't even see when we look at budgetary documents that is still fueling and feeding those wars. You know, and so, you know, when you look at the what's really happening in terms of wars of aggression and economic violence in this country, there are no differences between those two parties. You know, the differences are less than or smaller than minute. There is no difference. I mean, the difference is only in the perception of Americans to make us believe that we live in some kind of a democracy where we have a choice, and that, you know, whether one party is going to represent different interests. They both parties represent the same interest, the interest of the overclass. And, you know, you mentioned the Department of Defense. Well, it used to be the Department of War.
Department of War.
Right, it was changed after World War II. What to give it a kinder and gentler image, but that's exactly what it is. So we need to go back to calling it by its name. Call it what it is. It is the Department of War, or the Department of Aggression, or the Department of Organized Violence. Call it what it is. They're not, you know, they don't defend nothing. You know, it's an offensive intervention over in the Middle East, and offensive interventions in South and Central America and in the Philippines and all over the globe for the last, century. So, you know, let's call it what it is. Let's recognize the parties of the overclass for what they are, call them what they are, and drop the charade, which is what we're trying to do right here. So.
Exactly. We look at the U.S.'s budget pie. If there was a pie, the U.S., you know what I'm saying, spends 18% of its annual budget, all right, the government, you know what I'm saying, spends 18% of its annual budget, which is your tax dollars, my taxes, everyone's tax dollars is listening, and the other 300 million-plus people in this country, 18% on past military escapades, a la wars and those types of things. 18% of the budget is still being spent on past wars. So that means that people that are listening right now, your kids, your grandkids, will probably be paying for these wars that are going on right now, these illegal occupations that are going right now, because 30% goes into current military. All right, 44%. About 44% of your tax dollars, your federal tax dollars, go to the military. Go to the military. And with that, speaking of the military, we got a militant mind on the line right now. It's about that time. It's about the time to introduce our guest of the hour, who is Mr. Monty Smith. He's joining us from North Carolina, I believe that's where I know he's from, North Carolina, but he may be calling us from North Carolina or someplace else. But I just want to introduce Monty Smith. Monty, you're on with Solomon of Your World News and my co-host Peter Fowler, who's in Glendale, Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona. Monty, you're on. If you can, you're welcome once again. This is your second time on Your World News. It's a pleasure. You're one of my favorite spoken word artist. I know about you, but probably most of the listeners don't know about you. So if you could introduce yourself, who you are, and how you came to be, as radical as you are, as progressive as you are, on the microphone and with a pen in your hand. Hello? Oh, hold on one second. That's my bad. I'm trying to get Monty on the line. And just give us one second. Monty, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, yes. All right. Did you hear what I said before?
Yes, I did. And thank you for those kind words. I appreciate that. Thank you very much. And it's an honor to be on your show. As I've mentioned to you in emails before, that you are by far one of my favorite social writers. And more people need to read your writings, and we'll talk about that later in the interview.
Appreciate it.
But I'm calling from a secret location in North Carolina. A lot of people joke about that. Hey, do you tell anybody where you're from, or blah blah blah? And it's best to leave certain things out, especially taking the road that I do. But to explain to the listeners who I am, my name is Monty Smith. I'm a street poet from North Carolina. I'm an activist first, poet second, and my main mission and goal with my poetry is to educate young white children coming up in America so they don't follow into the footsteps of their parents and grandparents, therefore adding fuel to this racist monster of a machine that we call the United States of America.
Thank you. And I'm going to, you know, take a stab at the first question, and I'll let Peter ask the second question. But this was totally extemporaneous because I wasn't planning on asking this question, but you brought up something. As soon as you said what you said, it reminded me of what Malcolm said when he said that, it's not up to black people to go into to white communities and convince white folks to try to plead with them to stop being racist and stop being white supremacists. He said black people are not the problem. White folks, genuine white folks, need to go into their own communities, and they need to do the strong legwork there, and in terms of ending racism and white supremacy. And so that's my question is you just said something that you're an activist first, and that your job is to work with white youth. How did you come to grow up in North Carolina? How did you come to have that kind of mindset? And also, if you could, I think you've got a great story. If you could also give the listeners a backdrop in terms of the stuff that you've been through, because you've been in the front lines going to Klan rallies, am I correct? And actually literally fighting.
Yes, I have. Make a long story short, that's how I cut my teeth, so to speak. In the late 80s and early 90s, in North Carolina, and I'm glad that you're bringing this up because through past interviews, this question keeps remaining. A lot of people, they don't understand that the South is still, the South in the terms of race, in the terms of how the majority, which is white people, look at everyone else. If you step outside of the South, if you go to Los Angeles, if you go to Seattle, if you go to Chicago, if you go to New York, a lot of people they don't get what I'm saying because they've never had the experience of watching the Ku Klux Klan march down the street and instill terror into every citizen that is in the area that can view this. This is not the new South. That must be stated. That is a big misconception. The South is still a plantation. It is still open 24/7, 7 days a week. The majority is still profiting off poor people and using them as profit through the prison industrial complex, and it's very alive and well in the South, from Alabama to Florida to South Carolina to North Carolina to Virginia, Tennessee. Things haven't changed that much. I mean, look at the Tea Party. Look at the social unrest right now when it comes to race. The president, the militia group in Minnesota today, or in Michigan today, things are really showing themselves. And I think we've been in denial in this country a long time about the real racial code that exists. But back in the late 80s, early 90s, in Thomasville, North Carolina, Winston-Salem, North Carolina, Greensboro, North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina, Burlington, North Carolina, Mebane, North Carolina, all of these places had Klan rallies and marches. And, you know, every spring and summer there would sometimes be up to 3 marches for that year. No one was going to combat the Klan members. So we organized and started going and started pushing through the front line and doing whatever we had to do to disrupt the march and let people know, especially the white bystanders, that there were white people willing to stand up and weren't going to take it. And that goes back into the position that I am in now with my poetry. A lot of times you find white people that are willing to help in the struggle when it comes to racism in this country, but it seems like they can only identify if they're from the hip-hop generation or the rap movement. So you have a lot of white people that have a lot of great knowledge, but instead of going to white people, white areas, white events, and telling these white people what needs to be heard, they're going to black events and telling black people what they already know. And that's a problem, and that's got to stop. We have to stop preaching to the pulpits, and we need to go out and speak in hostile territory.
Right, right. Yeah, thank you. Peter, I know you had a question for Brother Monty.
Yeah, got quite a few questions for Monty Smith. Monty, this is Peter Fowler talking to you from Glendale, Arizona.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah, brother, and I familiarized myself with some of your work very recently, and love the work you're doing, man. Love it. I said to Solomon after I started to familiarize myself with your work, I said we need more brothers like this in the struggle, and quick comment. You know, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, so definitely not the South. But there's a case going on in the South right now. A brother by the name of Curtis Flowers, and this is in Mississippi. You know, it's the Deep South, man. And he's being prosecuted. He's about to undergo his 6th trial for the same murder. And I tend to think that this kind of thing probably would not happen outside of the South. That's another evidence, Monty, what you just said. You know, some of the things, racism, and it's different manifestations in different regions and in different age groups and so on and so forth. So appreciate your perspective on that in terms of understanding regionally. You know, and I mentioned to Solomon earlier when we were talking about the immigration struggle about how that looks like here close to the border in Arizona. But let me ask you this question. In terms of consciousness, you know, obviously you've got a radical, a progressive consciousness that is unique to white people. Talk to me about that consciousness in terms of how you would go about, and I know you go about it through your art, through your craft, in terms of the spoken word and through rap and through poetry. But if you had a broader agenda, you know, talking about how to create a consciousness of anti-racism on a broad level amongst white people, and maybe we need to limit it to, you know, younger white folks who haven't been as jaded in this country. But how do we go about doing that? You know, what are we going to do? So, you know, if you could just talk a little bit about, you know, how to bring about a consciousness of anti-racism amongst white people.
Okay, good question. I've said it once and I'll say it again. It starts at home. Racism isn't inherited, it is taught. Only white people can end white supremacy. And basically, parents need to do a better job of teaching humanity to their children and teaching them that they are more than just the color of their skin. Once again, it starts in the home first. But the problem is that the majority of people in this country are not in tune enough to be able to teach their children the real direction that they must follow to be able to break down white supremacy and to get other people, non-whites in this country, to realize that, you know what, there are white people willing to help. There are white people willing to put themselves on the front line, not because at the end of the day it's the good old story of like Blindside, you know, white people coming to the aid of black people. No, it is about, it's real simple. It's about right or wrong. It's about life and death, and it is about humanity and justice. And those words are thrown out so much that they have lost their power. But justice is that if one eats, we all eat. You know, everyone in this country, we all need clothes, food, and shelter. Everything else is whatever. If we can't embrace one another on that just genuine beginning level of humanity, then we're going to have a country like we have now. So it is up to white people who feel the same way that I do to do more than just, you know, speak to their, you know, neighbors, or if they see something, say, oh, well, children, that's bad. You don't want to, you know, follow in those footsteps. You need to be proactive. If you see something happening in the street, if you see something happening at a school, at a mall, and you know that it's wrong, then you need to step in. If you hear another white person on the street, in a school, in your workplace, making derogatory or racial comments, then you need to call that person out. White people have to pick up the staff and realize that we are the problem, and I understand that. I am a white man. I'm very, very white. I'm as pale as it gets. And there is a huge problem with white people willing and wanting to accept responsibility for the past. And that's what I am trying to do. That's what I've always tried to do. I understand by being white that I have privilege, even though I may be as poor as the man beside me. But I have privilege because I am white. This is a white-dominated Christian country, and it was founded for and by white Christian men. Hollywood is still reflecting that white image. Mass media, most of the music, I mean, everything that you see is from a white reflection. So if you're non-white in this country, where do you stand? Where do you fit in? We have to start breaking down the way we look at each other as white people, and we need to, like I said, teach the youth not to look at non-whites as, you know, basketball players, migrant workers, all of the titles that white America likes to throw out for everybody who is non-white that might be doing something good. We are all people, and we have to get back to that primitive first lesson that we all have to each one teach one and embrace one another. But it goes back to the home. It goes back with children first, and being willing to stand up and point out the wrongs when you see it and be proactive. I am not a savior. I am not the savior. But if I can reach 5, 10, 15, 25, 100 white people and get them on the correct page, then I feel that I have done something to better humanity. And a lot of people aren't willing to even go that far.
Right. You're right. And I'm glad you brought that up. And folks, I have a treat for you. Right now, this is probably my one or two favorite poems by Monty Smith, and probably unequivocally one of the my favorite spoken word pieces that I've heard within the last, you know, I would say year or so. This is a powerful piece, and I want to play this, and this is the reason why you won't hear or see Monty Smith on any corporate mainstream television station performing his pieces. You won't see him on BET or MTV, both owned by the large corporation Viacom, because of not just what he brings to the table in terms of what you just heard, in terms of how he described his role as a white man in America in terms of destroying white supremacy and institutional racism from the schools, from homes, and also from schools, because we know schools teach white supremacy every single day in America. The celebration of Christopher Columbus is probably the most basic and easiest and rudimentary way I can explain how white supremacy is taught, but it gets even more deep than that and more nefarious. But this is a piece, man.
It starts with the Pledge of Allegiance every morning.
Oh, gosh, right there, yeah. I mean, even better example, because that's every morning. It goes to the point you mentioned that this country was based on white ideals and Christianity. And yeah, I pledge allegiance under whatever, you know what I'm saying, and indivisible, one God, you know what I'm saying? Well, anyway, I'm glad I can't remember. But I want to play this piece right here. This piece is absolute fire. And on the other end, Monty, because I've never asked you this before, but I want to know what precipitated you to write this song this piece, the spoken word piece. And quite simply, it's why I write. And this is Monty Smith.
It's funny. Every time I'm interviewed, I'm always asked, what makes you write the way you do? Well, I write like I do because John Brown inspired me to. Because I'm an abolitionist. Because of the no-fly list. Because of unjust taxes. Because the pigs are still using poor people as target practice. Because 9/11 was an inside job. Because the School of Americas is still open. Therefore, Latin America is still open to rob. Because the majority of blacks in this penal colony still follow the master's religion. Because we're killing ourselves over simple traditions. Because James Byrd has been forgotten. Because greed is starving our souls. Because Babylon is so rotten. Because Brandon McClellan's story hasn't been told. I write like I do because the Move 9 needs me to. Because you may be seeking change, but Obama won't free Mumia. Because someone raped and killed Sister Rita. Because AIDS is man-made. Because the CEOs killed Brother Wade. Because hate caved in Emmett Till's head. Because most whites believe racism is dead. Because there's a war against the youth and no one cares. Because Curtis Mayfield died broke in a wheelchair. Because the mark of the beast isn't 666, it's the cross around your neck. Because rap music is under corporate check. Because 160 private prisons are functioning in 26 states. Because our sanity is at stake. Because revolutionary music is under federal attack. Because many of you haven't read the Patriot Act. I write like I do because Peter Tosh told me to. Because Western civilization equals white domination. Because manifest destiny has been replaced by globalization. Because no child left behind is a joke. Because the 60s traded revolution for disco and coke. Because resistance is all I taste. Because what's popular ain't real. It's programming that kills, like believing in religion, money, and race. Because my brother committed suicide. Because there's a digital divide. Because Shaquanda Cotton has been forgotten. Because Unicor is profiting off the poor. Because Babylon is so rotten. Because mentally, mama can't take it anymore. I write like I do because very few are willing to. Because it feels good not to fit in. Because we need more sit-ins, mass rallies, and teach-ins. Because riot police don't wear numbers or names on their uniforms. Because the U.S. has signed over 400 treaties with the Indians and violated every one. Because Bill Hicks is dead and gone. Because when it comes to reparations, it's the same old song. Because no one group can start the people's revolution. Because solidarity is the only solution. Because we live in a world where the darker you are, the more hunted you are. Because I don't like religious nationalism. Fascism is fascism. Because the Coca-Cola and Banadex courts in Colombia are killing union leaders. Because I love my daughter, but it's getting harder to feed her. Because revolution is bloody, and most slaves aren't willing to face it. I write like I do because there's blood in this poetry, and I want you to taste it.
I'm sorry. I lost a little bit. The line you had me at, revolutions are bloody. You had me there, and then you took me home with I want you to taste it, man. Monty, yeah, can you, man, you touched on so many things that even go beyond racism, white supremacy, capitalism, prison industrial complex, man, Coca-Cola union organizers being killed by the U.S.-supported Uribe government in Colombia. Why did you write that piece? What drove you to write that piece, man?
Well, how I end the poem with there's blood in this poetry and I want you to taste it. We are all at stake in this, and we all have we're all responsible. You know, there's blood on all of our backs. No one is clean. No one is free in this country from the things that I stated. You know, every time you buy Coke, you know, you're supporting Coke and you're supporting what's happening in Latin America. You know, you got to look where your dollar's going. The main reason why I wrote that poem is because I'm tired of hearing poetry that doesn't address the problems. There's freedom of speech, great, if that's what you want to call it. But every poetry night that you go to, it's usually the same old tired, beaten poem. King looking for queen, queen looking for king, teenage angst to middle age crisis angst to, you know, wanting to have fun. I've had problems all week at work, you know, now I've come to the poetry night and I just want to relax and let go. Well, the continuation of relaxing and letting go is the reason why we are at this dire state that we are now. Like I said in the poem, the 60s traded revolution for disco and coke. You know, what happened to the movement of the 60s and the early 70s? What happened? Who came in and who snuffed that out? Look at COINTELPRO. Look at Fred Hampton. Why does no one know about Sam Greenlee's The Spook Who Sat by the Door? There is a lot of information that is not being given, and that is why the masses are stupid. That's why the masses are ignorant, and that's why we are in the situation that we are in, because we are kept dumb through the school system, through chasing 40 to 60, 80-hour week work checks for a job that's giving you no benefit, that's giving you, you know, nothing really to strive for, to believe in. You're just trying to feed your family. You're barely doing that. I love my daughter, but it's getting harder to feed her. You know, I don't make any money at what I do. Because why? I'm trying to help people. There's no profit in the cure.
Exactly.
There's no profit in the cure, you know. So a lot of people, they say, well, you need to be doing this. You need to be doing that. I can't afford it. You know, it's amazing how hard it is to push my book. You know, my new book, Don't Shoot the Hostages, Poetry and Social Commentary for the New World Survivalist. I get 100 to 150 friend requests a day on Facebook. You know how many people, you know how many 150 have bought one of my books? None. Okay? So I know who buys the books. I can see. I can track it. I can see who's purchasing the books. We are selling books, but not at the number that we need to be. And once again, let me say, for all the profit that is made off the books, they go back into making more books. I'm not on some press. I'm putting these books out myself. And it takes a lot of money to put books out and to get them into all of the hands that need to hold them. So not only am I spending all of my money that I can work for to get to send books out to incarcerated people and people, you know, outside of the country that are willing to help, you know, but I'm also trying just to get the books out for those few people that who are ordering it. We don't want to look under the rug. When you buy Don't Shoot the Hostages, what you're doing is you're pulling the rug back and you are having to look at the problems that are not only affecting you, but that you might be responsible for, especially white people.
Exactly.
So the reason why I wrote that poem is because there needs to be a wake-up within the edutainment department in this country. Karis One is not doing his thing like he used to anymore. People are not supporting him. People are not supporting Chuck D and Public Enemy because they're wanting to support the mainstream white corporate board genocidal garbage that's being shoved down every 13- and 15-year-old's throat. So the message is lost. It's lost in all of the confusion and mass illusion that Viacom is responsible for. They have killed the revolutionary. They have killed the word. And they have replaced it with Waka Flocka. They have replaced it with 106 and BET and MTV and on and on and on and on. So the reason why I wrote that poem is because we have to do something to wake up the youth. The youth are the rebellion. The youth are the revolution. And when I say revolution, I mean the changing of the mind so we can better our living conditions on a whole, not just for black people, brown people, green people, purple people, but for poor whites too. And why? And let me throw this out. Why is it that all poor white people always vote Republican? Why is it every time you see the Tea Party and you see all of these ignorant closet racists on television, you know, why do they continue to vote for the Republican Party? Because the message that white America has is working extremely well.
Right.
It's working extremely well. And no matter how much Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann or some of these quote-unquote left-right people are trying to, you know, oppose the right media, they're still playing into it.
Yep.
You know, I still can't trust CNN. I still can't trust Headline News. I still can't trust any of the major media outlets for truth. You know, I mean, I'm not going to get it. You know, look at the uprising that happened in Greece. Nobody covered that on major television news here. They might have gave a second to it, but every time they saw people bashing with the police, bashing with the fascist regime that has been killing poor people in Greece for all of these years for profit, it's come about. But you didn't hear about it. Why? Maybe because people here might start to think about the poor people's movement again. It might want to fund or get involved or participate with the poor people movement. That's why Martin Luther King was killed. That's why Malcolm X was killed. Not because of their racial stance, but because they started opposing Vietnam. They started talking about the redistribution of wealth in this country, and they started talking about the poor people's movement and trying to educate poor young white people to understand that they are being systematically killed by the same government that they supposedly are embracing. Once again, why do poor white people always vote Republican? Why did Sarah Palin have 7,000 people come out in Nevada a couple of days ago? Where are our numbers? So that's what it comes back to. We have to continue to keep these conversations going. Solomon, you have to continue to keep interviewing people like me. People such as myself need to continue putting out books, regardless if you're going broke to do it, because at the end of the day, we might be saving someone's life.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, you're right, bro. So I want to give our listeners the opportunity to tap into that, Monty. So, you know, before I ask, I got a question I want to ask you, but I want to give you this opportunity now. Let everybody know, let our audience know where they can reach you, what your website is, your information, and how we can buy that book. So let's get that info out there. So give us that info right now, bro.
Okay, you can go to www.streetpoetmontysmith.com, and Monty is spelled with an E. Once again, www.streetpoetmontysmith.com. Monty is spelled with the E. The book, the paperback, is $12 plus shipping and handling. The downloadable ebook is only $5. It's only $5.
Yeah.
The book is only $12. You can go and look up a lot of people's poetry books today. You will see they're selling them for $20, $30, $40. I am just asking for change, just enough to keep more books being made, so we can continue to get these books into the hands of all the young white people that are growing up, and we need to catch them while they're young, because if we don't, they're going to grow up to be Willie Lynch or Jim Crow, or they're going to grow up to be a closet racist like so many of our senators and congressmen.
Right. And it's a great book. I have the e-book, courtesy of Monty, and that it's a great book. And as someone who has self-published three books myself, I can tell you, folks that are listening right now, it's a huge undertaking for an author to self-publish any book. It's a huge undertaking, and you're basically coming out of your pocket to publish these books, you know, not because it's not worthy to be published by a large mainstream, but why the hell would you? Because as soon as you give your work to you get signed by a huge mainstream, you know, author house, what they have carte blanche to say, well, Monty, we don't like this, but it's a little too political. You know, we want to take this out. We take this word out. We take this sentence out. And that's, you know, and so that's why a lot of folks, you know, choose the option to self-publish. And so it is a huge, and so when he says that he needs to sell books, to make more books, trust me, that's the case. I'm in the same boat. That is exactly the case, and so that's why I've started to write a lot of my pieces and just, you know, do weekly commentaries and send them out to folks while I you know, save the pennies to try to, you know, publish again and then, you know, be able to put all these pieces together in one collective. So people, support him. Street Poet Monty Smith with an E .com. Go there, you know, don't shoot the hostages. And why don't shoot the hostages? What's with that title of the book?
The reason why I called the book Don't Shoot the Hostages is because poor people have to stop killing one another. We are not the problem, okay? The people that are systematically killing poor people for profit are the corporations and the bloodlines that prop up these state governments to make you think your vote counts. Stop killing your neighbors. Stop degrading your neighbors. Stop killing and taking your frustration out on people who are stuck in the same economic systematic situation as yourself. Because it's easy. It's easy to have the world on your shoulders. You can't feed your family. Your car just broke down. You don't know how you're going to pay rent. You're going to check your mailbox, and the neighbor beside you had a smart-ass comment. The next thing you know, you're in the back of a squad car, and you're going to the prison industrial complex to make the government more money because you just shot your neighbor. That happened in my neighborhood not long ago. Okay? Stop looking at your fellow brother and sister as the enemy. Start to love your fellow brother and sister and realize that there is power in solidarity. Realize that there is love in making all of us accountable. Solidarity is the only solution. Like I said in the poem, not one group, Not one group is going to be able to start the people's revolution. I am not for black power. I am not for white power. I am not for brown power. I am for people power. We have to get back to understand that we are humans first. We are humanitarians. We are loving people, and we need to act as such. The way that the system has turned us out into these monsters that the news constantly calls us and describes us as on their 7 and 11 o'clock headlines, it's got to stop. We are fueling that. Poor people have a lot to do with the situation that we're in. We continue to accept, we continue to accept being pissed on for nothing. There is strength in numbers. There is ways to organize. There can be a solidarity movement in this country, just like there was in Poland. And it is going to take people, you know, to say, you know what? I am powerful. I am just one person, but I can make a change. If it's nothing more than just creating a youth poetry workshop in your neighborhood where you're getting a hold of the kids instead of the television or instead of the gangs or instead of this or instead of that, you corral them in. You teach them right for wrong. Give them an outlook. Put a notebook in their hand. Teach them that writing is powerful and can save their lives, because once you reflect everything that's going on inside you on a piece of paper and you stare back at it, you are now looking at yourself in a way you never have before. And when you do that for a 10-year-old kid that's coming from the slums, when you're doing that for a 14-year-old kid that's coming from the slums, that's been beaten on, that's been told he'll never be or amount to shit, when you can do that for that child, you are creating a revolutionary. Don't shoot the hostages. Stop taking out your bullshit and your problems on everyone else and realize that there is strength in our numbers.
That's powerful, man. That's powerful. You know, you mentioned, you know, all these conditions that are prevalent in our society. And in some of your, number of your works, you know, you talk about delusional, people being delusional, folks being delusional, which, you know, is a denial about reality. And what it's going to take to overcome that. And another allusion that you make in some of your work is to Babylon. All right. So, you know, looking at those with those two concepts in mind, those two ideas, talk a little bit about that metaphor of Babylon, because that used to be a really powerful metaphor for understanding certain cultural conditions. And I don't know if it has as much as broad an understanding today. So. Talk about what you mean, what you are referring to with that kind of a metaphor of Babylon, and why you see our society right now as Babylon. What does that mean, and then how do folks come to grips with that and wake up to it?
Okay, when I think of America, and I label it as Babylon, is because, for example, in 1987, 1% of the United States population owned 33% of the wealth. Okay. Hmm. That could only be created by using 30 to 40 million souls and keeping them in poverty, okay? 1.7 million Americans are currently in prison. This is a 300% increase since 1980, and most of it is non-violent offending acts, okay? So right there we see how the prison industrial complex, which is the largest grossing private business sector in this country, okay, there's something to that. Only 29% of the U.S. prison population is incarcerated for violent crimes. This includes rape, murder, assault. The rest of the dangerous folk reside there mostly for burglary and property damage. Okay, a century and a half after the collision of two cultures in 1492, over 100 million indigenous souls have disappeared. And
right.
Look and look at us today. Look at Waco. Look at Katrina. Look at the welfare state in this country. Look at the. I mean, it's funny, you know. Like, I mean, you can just walk out your door and just go for a mile walk, you know, and look around and look at the look on most people's faces. Most people are suffering. There is not a middle class anymore. You're either rich or you're poor. And most poor people who might consider them middle class, these are people who have 4, 5, 6, 8 credit cards. They're all maxed out. They don't have any more credit that they can get. The mortgage is already their backs are against the wall. Most people that I know, their backs are against the wall. You know, America does nothing to benefit its people. Obama is a joke. The whole idea that there is change now because we have a black president is a joke. Look at the last 8 years before Obama. Look how bad that George Bush drove everything into the ground, and he was just a puppet. There was a bigger hand at that. But look at what he did. So they realized, you know what? The only way we can get the American people, or we can convince the American people to realize, you know, they don't need to revolt, that their votes do count, we're going to put someone in power that looks maybe like them. So what has been the backlash? All of these white people, middle class, working people, they're coming out from the woodwork, they're claiming the Tea Party, and they're talking about all of the atrocities that Obama is presenting. When
right.
What Obama has on his plate was the same plate Bush had. But because he is black and George Bush was white, it was okay. But now that Obama's here, it's socialism. It's a government takeover. Healthcare is going to kill you. Blah, 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 blah. When the
right.
United States, regardless of its president, is already killing poor people for profit every day. There has been no wages. There has been no raises in wages because most of the businesses, small businesses in the United States, you know, they can't afford to hire new people. They can't afford to give the people that they do have working any increase in wage. So what happens? You've got more and more people going and getting unemployment checks. More and more people are filing for Medicaid. More and more people are finding themselves with nothing. That doesn't sound like paradise to me. That sounds like
right.
Babylon, where the system is killing the people for profit, when the system isn't even really a system. It's just a handful of people hiding behind what we consider and think of as a government, or what has been taught to you through your bullshit history and political and social economic textbooks.
Yeah. Well said, bro. Well said.
Matter of fact, they call it a democracy. We have a two-party system. That if you look up democracy by definition, takes more parties than two people.
Right. You know, and so as you talk about that, you know, the very characteristics that you're talking about, one could understand why you would say it feels good not to fit in, right?
It feels real good not to fit in.
Yeah, it feels good not to fit in, and you know, I can relate to that. But you know, and you talked earlier about, you know, reaching particularly the young people of white America, who, as young people and as white people, one of their high priorities is to fit in. So, you know, how do you try to bridge that when you're trying to reach a generation and a cultural group that is striving to fit in, and your message is, man, it feels good to not fit in, and you don't want to fit in with this Babylon. You know, how do you go about making that connection, bro?
Well, a lot of time I tell white people, what did you think about Los Angeles in 92?
Uh-huh.
And most people will go, what, do you mean the riots? And I see, well, right there, you called it a riot. I call it an uprising. Even though every Latino and black man and woman and child in South Central, the day the uprising started, should have stayed at home, and those streets should have been full of white people going to white neighborhoods and burning down houses and burning cars and burning grocery stores. White people should have said, you know what? We've got this. Because the system isn't for you, poor white man and woman. And for you to think that there is some connection between the federal government and America and you because you have white skin, you are an idiot. And you are misinformed, and you better get onto the bandwagon, because when the revolution does start, you'll be the first shot.
Right. That's right. Deep, bro.
Okay? When I'm talking to children, you know, there's leading issues, you know, arts and culture, corporate and media accountability, education and students' rights, environmental rights, globalization. We have to break down globalization and look at what that's doing to the world, the labor in all of these third world countries, economic justice, understand what hip-hop activism is, understanding what housing and gentrification, which is going on in Spanish Harlem, which is going on in Chicago, which is going on in Los Angeles. We have to get back to human rights, multiculturalism. What is multiculturalism? We have to get these words into young white children's mouth and get them giving us definitions. You know, and when I say we need to do this, I'm meaning me and other white people who are willing to take the charge and get these young white people to understand where we are coming from as the small minority, because we are a small minority of whites. We've always been around. Look at John Brown.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Look at the '60s. Look at the kids from New York and the big cities up north that were coming to the South for fighting for voter rights. I mean, a lot of those white kids were killed.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are white people that can see that their forefathers and this country is full of shit. It is full of hate. It is full of supremacy. It's full of segregation. It's full of people thinking that they are better just off the sake of their skin color.
Yeah.
I am not for that. Okay? There are a lot of white people that aren't for that. But we, our mission is to educate more white children for them to get up at 14 and 15 and be proud to say, you know what, I'm not going to fit in. Fuck you, Grandpa. You're an old racist asshole. You know what, don't ever speak to me again until you can get some consciousness.
Right. All right. All right.
Yeah, I definitely feel that. Monty, what were your early influences growing up? I mean, you grew up in a town that was
I grew up in racism.
Yeah.
I grew up in racism.
How did you break away from that bifurcate and separate yourself from and develop a consciousness that was anti-racist?
Because when I was younger, I started listening to music, and I started listening to punk rock music and hardcore music and rap music. And I hear a lot of interviews and activists and revolutionaries speak, but they never really talk about their main influence. My main influence was the Dead Kennedys, was Black Flag, was Public Enemy, were these older kids in these different scenes creating different types of music, teaching, hey, look around, open your eyes, understand you're either part of the problem or part of the solution. And to be part of the solution, then you've got to break the shackles on your feet, and you've got to understand where you're coming from, who you're from, what they did, and how you are going to combat it and not fall into the same traps and the same system that has been laid out for you to profit off of. You know, it's easy for to be a white man to walk into most places and not have any apprehension. You know, that's white privilege. You know, a lot of whites don't understand that they have white privilege, that they might be riding down the road. There could be a Latino or there could be a black guy or a black woman in the car beside them. The cop, who do you think the cop is going to pull first? Even if that cop is black, who do you think they're going to pull first?
Yeah. Exactly.
You know? I mean, and as much as I hate the white racist structure in this country, you know, I also hate the mentality of black cops and black military buying into this we are all together bullshit that the system tries to provide. Be an army of one.
Right.
Come on, man. You're talking about the flag that accosted you, and you're going to support it?
Love it.
You're going to go to other third world countries? And let's think about it. Most wars are killing who? Brown and black people. Look at Africa. Look at Iraq. Look at Afghanistan.
Right, right.
When is the last time the America has fought anybody white?
Right, exactly. Exactly. And Monty, we have a caller on the line. I think that might want to ask you a question.
Sure.
Caller?
Yes. Can you hear me, Solomon?
Yeah. Oh, yes, I can hear you. Thunder, how you doing, brother?
Hey, man, I just got to tell you, this is such an awesome show. And, Monty, first of all, I want to commend Your World News for, you know, the courage of putting this message out there as powerfully as it's being put out there. And I apologize for not being tuned into the name of your co-host.
Oh, Peter Fowler.
Peter, yes, Peter. Thank you for the work that you're doing also. But Monty, I wanted to just join in what you're saying about this point of it feels good not to fit in, you know. And I see this as this system where white people are born into a system of white supremacy and privilege by the mere accident of their skin color. And whites are by birth born into and complicit in racism until they affirmatively opt out. And that's what I'm hearing you say, that you have and many others have affirmatively opted out of this system of fascism and racism. And to me, Monty, and Your World News, this is a lesson for people of color that we cannot fall into the trap of hating all white people, so to speak, or fall into the same sort of oppressor mentality that has been put upon us, where we begin to hate a whole race of people without understanding that everybody isn't in that bag of white supremacy. And I really commend you for what you're doing, Monty, and this message of solidarity, because I think that's where it's really coming from. We have to come together, and solidarity and love is truly the answer. And that doesn't mean that we are afraid to defend ourselves, but it means that we can't go into this battle hating each other or hating, period. So that's my comment, and I just want to just applaud you for the courage and the work that you're doing, because like you said, those of us who are in the struggle know that there is no profit in the cure, because capitalism is about, like the healthcare system, a sick care system that says, I'll help you as long as I can figure out a way to profit from it. Exactly. But if I can't profit from your misery, then, brother, you're just out of luck.
Exactly.
So anyhow, thank you, gentlemen, for
thank you
awesome
for those kind
show.
Words. I appreciate that.
Yes.
Thanks for calling in, Thunder. And Thunder, before you get offline, I'm a big fan of your show as well, and I know your show also appears online, but I'm privy to hear it on Sundays because I live in D.C. But is there a way? I know you have a Facebook page. Is there a way folks can get a hold of the Talking Feather?
Yeah, well, Solomon, we're like you, like Your World News. We're on Blog Talk Radio too, and we're on Talking Feather Radio every Wednesday at 4:00. So we've been on for about a year now, and we have about 50 broadcasts that we have 50 episodes that we've put out there, talking about the indigenous knowledge, indigenous people, and the intersection of the indigenous African and the indigenous Native American. And that's sort of the theme that we come from, to say that there's a lot for all of us to benefit from embracing this indigenous knowledge, which is really what Monty is talking about. You know, once we come together to a state of higher consciousness and understand that we have to find a balance in life, and that balance in life is for whites, is to come to a healing where you come to grips with this
genocidal past.
That's right. There's this guilt that, you know, indigenous people, we can't go around hating each other because we have to forgive. And so there's something that we each have to do in order to really put meaning to this quest for solidarity. And that is, you know, we have to get over our psychic trauma. Those who were oppressed, the indigenous Native Americans, the indigenous Africans, and others who were oppressed, we have to move past our hate, our mentality of victimization. And whites have to move past their guilt and come to a sort of a truth and reconciliation, where we can come together as a people and recognize that there is a system that is oppressing all of us.
And it's about profit. It's about money.
Exactly.
At the end of the day, they want Black Michael fighting White Johnny because it is profitable.
Yes.
Love,
so Solomon,
is not profitable.
Solomon and Monty, and I don't want to, you know, take up valuable time with Monty, but yes, thank you for asking me about that. Talking Feather Radio every Wednesday at 4:00. And of course, we've been on the local DC market for 10, 11 years now, WOLAM.com, every Sunday at 11 o'clock.
If you would ever like to continue this conversation, Thunder, I'd love to be on your show sometime if you can make room.
Well, Monty, what are you talking about? Can I make room, brother? Look. I can make room. We can make room. Penny Gamble Williams, the co-host, and myself can definitely make room, and we will send out an invitation to you, and we will work it out because, like your world news, we need to give people like you a platform to raise us to a higher consciousness.
And we, at the end of the day, we just need to continue this conversation going. And if by every broadcast we can reach 5, 10, 15 people, if we're only reaching one person, then all of us as humans, we're doing a better job to create a better future.
Aho, amen.
Right. Thank you so much, Thunder. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Good meeting you.
All right. Take,
Take care. Peace and blessing.
Peace and blessing. And Monty, we have a few minutes left, so I want to give you the last word. And starting off, can you give your email address out to folks, especially since Thunder put out that
sure, not a problem.
A great opportunity for you to come on the show, and there might be other folks that might want to have you, come to their organization, come to their school, and which includes me. I'm going to try to bring you on campus and. Next semester to do a show. So if, can you give your email address out and also any venues that you might be performing in the near future?
Okay. My email address is streetpoetmontysmith@gmail.com. Once again, streetpoetmontysmith@gmail.com. Once again, Monty is spelled with an E. Once again, for anyone who is interested in purchasing the book, Don't Shoot the Hostages, Poetry and Social Commentary for the New World Survivalists, please visit www.streetpoetmontysmith. I don't have any upcoming shows at the moment because this is probably the 9th interview that I've done in the last week. The interviews are coming in very heavy right now, and I would really like to continue these interviews going because where maybe I might go to a poetry night, reach 100 or 200 people through these outlets such as yours, we're reaching a lot more. So I'm not saying that I won't do shows, but right now I just have a lot of interviews coming up, and I'm really pushing this book. This book is so important. It's important for me to go to the local poetry night or go out of state and perform and do poetry for 15 or 30 minutes, but this book will last. It's like the old saying, if you teach someone how to fish, then they can feed themselves. If I can get these books into the hands of the youth and for conscious-minded white, black, brown, purple, green, yellow people, we can make a change. There's solutions in this book. It's just not bringing up all the problems and woe is me, what are we going to do? There are solutions in this book. And that is what we need to focus on is how can we come together? How can we organize? How can you organize in your neighborhood? How can you start youth poetry workshops? How can you help people of how can you just help anybody? I mean, it's we've got to rally around the fact that there's strength in numbers. There is a lot of people who feel the way that you and I do, Solomon, that Mr. Fowler, Thunder. There's a lot of people that feel the way we do, but why are we not connected? You know, why is there not a movement that we're following? And I would like to say that there has been a group that has been introduced to me and was introduced to me about 3 months ago, and I have joined their group, and in return they have joined my mission, and they are called AIM, the Anti-Injustice Movement, and they're out of the UK. And I would just like to say for anybody out there that would like to read more about AIM and can, you know, focus on, well, you know, I might want to start an organization. How do you do it? What do I do? Please check out www.antiinjustice.com. Once again, www.antiinjustice.com. We need more groups such as AIM. We need to create groups. We need to get people to join our groups. We need to link these groups together. And the common goal is solidarity. And once we get 1,000, 5,000 people, we can start asking one another, okay, what is it that we need to attack first? What do we need to address first? But until we have the numbers, you know, we're not really going to be able to knock the doors down that we need to. Just one person such as myself, I'm only going to reach so many people regardless of my book, regardless of my interviews, regardless of whatever the shows. But if we could all come together in groups that are really mobile, that are really working with each of us and our best hearts at mind, we can really make a change. And I would also like to send a shout out to AK, who runs AIM in the UK, she has fallen ill in the last couple of days, basically because she's working herself to the bone, because she understands the need, she understands the conviction, she understands the dire times that we live in, that we don't have a lot of time to fool around with, that we've got to stay active. And she stays so active that she's basically got herself sick into the hospital. So I want to send much love to AK in the UK, who I know is tuned in, who is listening. That's right, Solomon. You got a lot of people in Europe listening to you right now.
That's good.
We have a lot. We have a lot of people in Ireland. We have a lot of people in UK. We have a lot of people all over Europe, and the buzz is building. I'm getting a lot of friend requests. I'm getting a lot of emails from people over there that had never heard of me, that realize, you know, on a world level, there has to be this type of talk. And thank you, Solomon, for supporting this type of talk.
No, thank you so much, and thanks, Thunder, and thanks, Peter Fowler, for once again another great episode. And Monty, you made a great Thunder, made it great for calling in, and all the folks that are tuned in, and all the folks that are going to continue to support Your World News and to spread the word to their friends by sending a link. You know, you guys have made it good, because it's not about me, it's not about Peter, it's about the folks out there who need to hear these kind of messages from my show, from shows like Thunders and the other independent media that's out there to combat the disinformation that's put out there by the corporate media. So thank you, Monty. And this is by far not the last time that you're going to come in. So this is just a simple see you later. And I'll
talk
to you in email,
exactly.
Pass my phone. And since it's my show, fuck it. I'm going to go with Monty Smith closing out again. I'm going to play the same joint again, because it is my favorite joint by Monty Smith. So we'll see you guys next week. This is Monty Smith, Why I Write. And just like the great Martin Luther King, man, before he was killed, he was working on a piece that was called Why America May Go to Hell. And we can only imagine what that piece was going to be about, but it was, you know, why America may go to hell. And so he spoke truth to power. So did Steve Biko. And so does Monty Smith. This is Monty Smith, Why I Write. Thank you.
It's funny. Every time I'm interviewed, I'm always asked, what makes you write the way you do? Well, I write like I do because John Brown inspired me to, because I'm an abolitionist, because of the no-fly list, because of unjust taxes, because the pigs are still using poor people as target practice, because 9/11 was an inside job, because the School of Americas is still open, therefore Latin America is still open to rob, because the majority of blacks in this penal colony still follow the master's religion, because we're killing ourselves over simple traditions, because James Byrd has been forgotten, because greed is starving our souls, because Babylon is so rotten, because Brandon McClellan's story hasn't been told. I write like I do because the Move 9 needs me to. Because you may be thinking change, but Obama won't free Mumia. Because someone raped and killed Sister Rita. Because AIDS is man-made. Because the CEOs killed Brother Wade. Because hate caved in Emmett Till's head. Because most whites believe racism is dead. Because there's a war against the youth and no one cares. Because Curtis Mayfield died broke in a wheelchair. Because the mark of the beast isn't 666, it's the cross around your neck. Because rap music is under corporate check. Because 160 private prisons are functioning in 26 states. Because our sanity is at stake. Because revolutionary music is under federal attack. Because many of you haven't read the Patriot Act. I write like I do because Peter Tosh told me to. Because Western civilization equals white domination. Because manifest destiny has been replaced by globalization. Because No Child Left Behind is a joke. Because the 60s traded revolution for disco and coke. Because resistance is all I taste. Because what's popular ain't real. It's programming that kills, like believing in religion, money, and race. Because my brother committed suicide. Because there's a digital divide. Because Shaquanda Cotton has been forgotten. Because Unicor is profiting off the poor. Because Babylon is so rotten. Because mentally, mama can't take it anymore. I write like I do because very few are willing to. Because it feels good not to fit in. Because we need more sit-ins, mass rallies, and teach-ins. Because riot police don't wear numbers or names on their uniforms. storms because the U.S. has signed over 400 treaties with the Indians and violated every one, because Bill Hicks is dead and gone, because when it comes to reparations, it's the same old song, because no one group can start the people's revolution, because solidarity is the only solution, because we live in a world where the darker you are, the more hunted you are, because I don't like religious nationalism, fascism is fascism, because the Coca-Cola and Banadex courts in Colombia are killing union leaders, because I love my daughter, but it's getting harder to feed her, because revolution is bloody, and most slaves aren't willing to face it. I write like I do because there's blood in this poetry, and I want you to taste it.